In the 1940s, the United States government began a program called the Manhattan District Project. It involved the construction of a uranium-235 plant near Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It was one of four installations around the country that contributed to the development of the atomic bomb. Many of the scientists who worked at the Oak Ridge plant had been trained by an A.W. Dicus, who was head of the physics department at Tennessee Technical University. Dicus worked for a number of years in the state university system, then became disillusioned with his work, wasn't being satisfied as he wanted to be. And so in the 50s, he left, took a job as a science teacher at Florida Christian College. Brother Dicus died a few years ago at age 90. But one of the things he left as his legacy were the words of a poem that have now been set to music. There is beyond the azure blue a God concealed from human sight. He tinted skies with heavenly hue and framed the worlds with his great might. There was a long, long time ago a God whose voice the prophets heard. He is the God that we should know who speaks from his inspired word. Secure as life from mortal mind, God holds the germ within his hand. Though men may search, they cannot find, for God alone does understand. Our God, whose Son upon a tree a life was willing there to give, that he from sin might set man free and evermore with him could live. There is a God. He is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I am. Like Brother Dicus, most of us find that the real significant aspects of our life come in our relationship with the Father. And one of the passages over the years that has helped me to know this God and how to relate to Him is Genesis chapter 18. I'd like to begin our study there this morning and move from that passage on to Psalm 77 and then end up with Mark chapter 14. And as we study together, the relationship between the three passages will become more apparent. The first verse of Genesis 18 says that the Lord came to visit, bent over Abraham and wrinkled Sarah. They lived in a tent out in the middle of the desert, far from the mainstream of civilization, isolated from most folks. And so when three guests showed up at their tent home at the heat of the day on one occasion, it was quite a rare instance for them to have this company. And perhaps it was mealtime, perhaps it was just the rarity of company, but Abraham invited them to stay for a meal. They agreed to do so. And then Abraham begins to hurriedly prepare that meal. In verse 6, it says that he hastens to the tent of Sarah, who apparently does not come out to meet the guests, and he tells her to quickly prepare some bread. And then in verse 7, he runs to the herd in the noonday sun out there in the desert, and he wrestles down one of the animals, has one of his servants hasten to prepare it. Well, having done all this activity, he brings the meal before his guests. This is the sort of activity that gives most of us a headache, all this rushing around, this hectic atmosphere. And what we actually have here is the first fast food restaurant in history. McDonald's could well model their lunch hour rush after Abraham's hasty preparation of this food. But Abraham's kind of lifestyle, for at least these few moments, is often reflected in the way we live, at least in the way I live. Often I'll get to the office early in the morning, get a blank sheet of paper, write down the 25 things I want to do that day. 25 things which, if done right, would take about 3 months to accomplish properly. But I have in mind doing them in one day, and then I fly. I make a couple phone calls, read an article, prepare part of a sermon, write some letters, give 7 things to the secretary to do. And the first time I realize that I'm rushing around like Madman Abraham is when I get this stiffness in my shoulders. And then I realize what's going on. But the haste is not the most significant part of the story, just as it's not the most important part of our lives. The narrative of rushing around turns to a dialogue of waiting in verse 9. The men have finished with their meal, they've washed up afterwards, and they begin to talk. And they ask Abraham the question, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" Now that question appears to come as somewhat of a threat to Abraham. He's not quite sure how they know that his wife's name is Sarah. I think that unsettles all of us. If we're in a position or a situation where we don't know anybody and someone knows us, we're a little bit wondering. We're a little bit alerted to the fact that these people know us and we don't know them. If someone comes up to me and says, "You're Harold Shank, aren't you?" and I don't know them, I want to know how they know me. Well, that's the situation Abraham seems to find himself in. And his reply is rather terse. He says, "She's in the tent." He's trying to stop this line of questioning. He's, in effect, saying, "Let's not talk about this anymore. I don't know how you know her name or how you know about us, but let's talk about something else. Sure is hot out here in the desert, isn't it?" Abraham's trying to do that, but the three guests won't allow that, and the probe continues. And they tell Abraham, "We're coming back in the spring, and Sarah's going to become pregnant and have a child, have a boy." Now, Abraham's taken back by all this because now not only do the three men know his wife's name, but they know that she's going to become pregnant, that the baby's going to be born, that the baby's going to be a boy, and they even know the due date of the baby. Now, in a congregation this size, there are always a number of people who keep track of who's pregnant. Sally, my wife, happens to be one of those. We were at a gathering of Highland people about a week ago, 70 or 80 people there. Sally came up halfway during the evening and said, "There are four ladies here who are pregnant." I don't know how she finds that out. I'm not quite sure why she keeps the census, but that's what's going on here. These men know that Sarah's going to become pregnant, and they know even ahead of time. Now, the narrator tries to be nice about all this. In verse 11, he says, "Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age, and had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women." He's just basically saying in his subtle way, have you taken a good look at Abraham and Sarah recently? They're not likely to be of childbearing years. Sarah's a little bit less subtle about her reaction. When she hears that she's going to become pregnant, she starts rolling on the tent floor, doubled over in laughter about the whole event. She just can't believe this is going to happen. Abraham doesn't say anything. He's so taken back by this news. But then the three men make this comment or question, ask this question, verse 14. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Is anything too hard for the Lord? The word hard there in Hebrew is the word palay. It can mean difficult, it can mean miracle, it can mean wonder, or it can mean impossible. Is anything impossible for this God? Is anything too hard for this God? And we'd really like to know the answer to that question. And as we finish reading this particular episode, we find that it's not answered. And we finish reading chapter 18, and it's not answered. We finish reading the Abraham stories, and there's still no answer to this question. We can read the whole book of Genesis, and it's not answered for us. And then we realize that the answer to the question really has to be an individual one. If you had been Abraham and Sarah out there in the desert, how would you have responded when the three men ask, "Is anything too hard for God?" Better yet, what about you? What about the God you believe in? If you really believed that God could do impossible things, how would that change the way you live, the way your life's going? Well, this concept of a God who can do impossible things runs throughout Scripture. I'd like to pull out three incidents this morning, see how they apply to our lives. The first one is right here in Genesis 18. I call it the God of the impossible and forgotten hopes. You have to understand the context here. Abraham in Genesis 18 is 99 years old. God had told him back when he was 75 that he was going to have a son. The baby's born when Abraham's 100. You have to admit, waiting 25 years for a bulge in Sarah's tummy is a long time to wait. Well, what had happened was Abraham had forgotten his hope. He had ceased to remember that he served a God who could do impossible things. Back in chapters 12 and 13, it seems as though Abraham begins to look to his nephew Lot as the one who's going to be receiving his inheritance. After all, God had made all these promises, said he's going to have someone to receive all these good things he had given to him. And so Abraham begins to look to Lot because Abraham is getting old. But God is up in heaven saying, "No, Abraham, that's not the one. There's going to be another." And then in chapter 15, Abraham has all the papers drawn up at the attorney's office to give his estate to his servant Eliezer of Damascus. Has all the papers signed. And Abraham thinks, this is where the inheritance is going to go, but God's up in heaven saying, "No, that's not the one, Abraham." A little bit later, Abraham marries a surrogate wife, has a child by her, finally has flesh of his flesh, bone of his bone, and he says, "This is the child that God had promised me." And God's up in heaven saying, "No, Abraham, that's not the one." And then finally, Sarah and Abraham have Isaac. Abraham's thinking during all this time is just uninspired. His goals are unimaginative. His hopes are lukewarm, all because he has forgotten that he served a God who could do the impossible. Now, what about you? Did you have, at one time, great dreams for what you were going to do in life? Did you plan to live in this world differently than your parents did? Did you plan to have broad interests, clearly defined goals, and an up-and-coming job by the time you got to this point? Did you have great dreams for your family and your marriage? Did you plan to sit down with your children every day and talk to them about God and about life? Did you dream of a marriage unlike any other marriage, a marriage of compassion and tenderness and dedication? Did you set out in life to lead your family to excellence? Did you have great dreams when you were baptized into Christ of what you would do for God? Did you have hopes of winning somebody at work or somebody in your family? Did you think of the great joy that you would have as a Christian? Or did you plan to really study Scripture and become an expert in part of it and become a Sunday school teacher? Did you have great dreams when you became part of this church, plans of making friends and being accepted and finding a spot? Have you forgotten those dreams? Have you forgotten that we serve a God who does the impossible, who takes a 90-year-old woman and makes her pregnant, who takes a lump of clay and makes a man, who speaks a word and the sun begins to shine? Or have you become like Abraham and tried all sorts of substitutes without relying on the God of the impossible? Or have you become like Sarah and laughed when you thought about what you once wanted and now have forgotten? What kind of God do you serve? Is He the God of the impossible who fulfills your hopes and inspires your thinking and directs your life? Or is He the God of the mere possible that you keep separated from your hopes in a box in the dresser drawer? You see, the question of Genesis 18 is still here. Is anything too hard for your God? Is anything impossible for the Lord you serve? The second passage I'd like to call your attention to is Psalm 77. And I want to consider this under the title of The God of the Impossible and a Troubled Spirit. The psalm nicely divides itself into three parts. The first four verses are a description of the poet's suffering, of his depression and discouragement. Verses 5 through 10 talk about how he conducts an experiment in life and finds that he's forgotten about his God. And then 11 through 20 talk about the praise and his memory of the God of the impossible. Listen as I read. I cry aloud to God, aloud to God that He may hear me. In the day of my trouble I seek the Lord. In the night my hand is stretched out without wearying, but my soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God and I moan. I meditate and my spirit faints. You hold my eyelids from closing. I am so troubled I can't speak. Here's a poet who has insomnia. He is so troubled that he prays out loud. And when he thinks about God, he groans and moans on the inside, and his faith has become a source of pain. He reaches out for comfort, but he doesn't find any. He prays out loud, but otherwise he can't speak. He's depressed. He's discouraged. He's troubled. And then in verses 5 through 10, he thinks about the past. It's almost as if he has a song about God's great activities in history, and he begins to sing it to himself, and he begins to think about what this God has done. And having thought about that, he then bursts forth in praise. Verse 11, I will call to mind the deeds of the Lord. Yea, I will remember thy wonders, thy palae, thy impossible deeds of old. Or verse 14, you are the God who works wonders, the word palae. You are the God who does the impossible and has manifested thy might among the peoples. And the poet remembers his God. And he remembers that this God has done impossible things. And he concludes his psalm with a list of God's great activities in history. His troubles are gone. His depression has disappeared, because he's remembered the God of the impossible. Now, what about you? Does your faith sometimes seem to cause you more difficulties than it solves? Do you focus on the problems rather than the joys of Christianity? Do you lose sleep over your problems? Have you been silenced by apathy or hate or bitter feelings? Do you feel like you're living life cut off from the past? Do you feel there's no answer to your prayers? Are you going it alone? Feel isolated, cornered, picked on, lonely? Have you forgotten about your God? Have you forgotten about the cries of a baby in the home of Abraham and Sarah? Have you forgotten about the picture of a 90-year-old woman changing diapers? Have you forgotten about a God who took a shepherd boy named David and made him king over Israel? Have you forgotten about a God who took a troubled Jonah, made him save a city? Have you forgotten about the God who took the chief persecutor of Christianity, Saul of Tarsus, and made him bring the gospel to the Western world? Have you forgotten about the God of the impossible who makes all things new, who offers abundant life to everybody, who says that the day is coming when He's going to make all nations dwell at peace with one another? What kind of God do you serve? Do you recall His mighty works? Do you remember how He split the Red Sea? How He caused His people to walk across the Jordan on dry ground? How He always led His people like a flock? Is your God the God of the impossible who turns this poet's insomnia to rejoicing? Who turns his depression to praise, his isolation to jubilation? Or do you serve a God of the mere possible? Who fails to see beyond one's own horizon and is trapped in a downward spiral of self-pity? You see, the question of Genesis 18 is still here. What kind of God do you serve? Is anything too hard for your God? Is anything impossible for Him? The third passage that I'd like to call your attention to is Mark 14, verse 32. It's near the end of the life of Jesus. The title here is The God of the Impossible and Seemingly Insurmountable Demands. And Jesus and the disciples went to a place which was called Gethsemane. And Jesus said to His disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And Jesus took with Him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And He said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here, watch." And going a little further, Jesus fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, that if it were possible, the hour might pass from Him. And He said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible with You." It was near the end of His life. No man had ever lived a life like Jesus did. Now He was about to die for something He didn't do, for people He didn't even know. And it seemed insurmountable. Death, pain, the cross, separation from the Father. Yet Jesus believed in a God who could do the impossible. He would say back in Mark chapter 10, verse 27, "With man it is impossible, but not with God. For with God all things are possible." Or over in Matthew chapter 17, verse 20, He would say, "For truly I say to you, if you have faith as a grain of a mustard seed, you'll say to this mountain, 'Move hence to yonder place,' and will move. For with God nothing is impossible." Surely God will be able to come to the rescue of Jesus. But Jesus was about to learn what it really means to serve the God of the impossible. Could this God, who had done so many miracles and wonders and impossible deeds in the Old Testament, could He save His Son from death? Could He save Him from the cross? Of course He could. But the point of the cross was to show that the God of the impossible deals with seemingly insurmountable tasks and demands in life by calling for death so that He can recreate life. Jesus will die, but He will live again. What about you? Do the demands of living the Christian life seem, well, insurmountable? Are you saying there this morning, "There's no way I can be like these people. There's no way that God could accept the things I've done. I can't forgive. I can't love my enemies. I can't give up my social life. I can't face the rejection of my friends. I can't change my lifestyle. I can't come out of my shell. I can't face the realities of life." Can you not seem to find the road to happiness? Have you been trying to do the things you want to do, not doing them, and doing the things you don't want to do? Have you not found any real purpose after all these years of searching? If you find yourself backed up against the walls of life with no exit, the God of the impossible has a message for you. You can't live unless you first die. Like the answer of God to Jesus, God allows us to overcome the insurmountable only when we die. Die to self, grieve over the way we've lived, give up our pride, sacrifice our lives to God. There's no well-being without suffering. There's no newness of life without giving up the old. There's no salvation without death. Jesus said we die in baptism. It's when we trust God. It's when He comes to save us. And you may say, "That's impossible." And that's right. It's impossible. But we serve a God who does the impossible every day. I serve a God who gives babies to wrinkled old women. I serve a God who moves mountains. I serve a God who finds a young girl and makes her have a baby, even though she's never slept with a man, and then tells her she's given birth to the Son of God. I serve a God who raises the dead, who builds a place called heaven, and who says, "I'm willing to come and live in your life." What about you? I know some of you have thought about baptism, and it may seem impossible in today's world that anyone would want to draw closer to God by being immersed in water. And that's right. It's impossible. But we serve a God who does the impossible all the time. And the fact is that unless you do the seemingly impossible things that this impossible God asks, you will find life insurmountable. You must die before you can live. One more thing. If you're here this morning and you believe in the God of the impossible, but you've not obeyed Him, don't leave without doing something about that. Don't leave without talking to somebody here. And you may say, that's impossible. And that's right. It's impossible. But we serve a God who does the impossible every day. If you need to respond, will you now, as we stand and sing?